when someone comes back from Tibet, I always ask them, like, so what are they like in Tibet? And then they always tell me, that's so funny. They always ask us, what are, like, the Chige and Gyalon and everyone else, like, what are they, the Tibetans outside Tibet like? My dad, he's been super involved in the movement since he was young. So Tibet Network was founded, I believe, in 2000. Being involved in the Tibet movement has definitely been the most meaningful thing that has happened in my life. I think I went to my first training when I was like 13 years old, and they made me do like a public speaking workshop, and I was so nervous and anxious. I think that was the closest that I know that I'll ever be to Xi Jinping. I know a really big problem for us now is also information gathering from inside Tibet. The 2 days never felt like it was enough because I always wanted to spend more time with my Tibetan friends. But ties are changing, narratives are shifting, people are looking at China differently these days.
Unsilenced, Voices of Young Tibetans is a podcast presented by the Foundation for Nonviolent Alternatives, where young Tibetans share their personal stories, experiences, opinions, and journey.
This is the late Namaste, and welcome to FMVS podcast, Unsilenced, Voices of Young Tibetans. Today we have with us a Tibetan who is among the leading youth leaders in our Tibetan community, advocating for Tibet. She's been involved in several Tibetan organizations that bring Tibet to the fore, and was deeply involved in the shutting down of the Confucius Institutes in Tufts University. I had the pleasure of meeting her recently during the second International Tibet Youth Forum, and more recently during the Asia Regional Meeting, which was organized by the International Tibet Network. Mm-hmm. Welcome to our show, Tinzi Yangzumla.
Thanks, Abdullah. Pleasure to be here.
So, Yangzumla, first, how was the Asia Regional Meeting, and what were the major takeaways that you found from this meeting?
The Asia Regional Meeting was a three-day conference or meeting where we brought together Tibet support groups and Tibet NGOs from all over Asia. And so we talked about our strategic campaigns and sort of what we want to do after going back to our homes, and, you know, really talk about whether we had any things we needed to work on or address as a nation or as a movement.
So personally, I also took part in the meeting and had the pleasure of taking the previous meeting as well. And I learned a lot, and I believe many of the participants learned a lot. So thank you for hosting it. And moving on, Yangzumla, like, you are a Tibetan who grew up in Dharamsala but eventually moved to the States, and mm-hmm. I mean, grew up mostly there. So how does it feel being a Tibetan there?
Yeah, in the US, I think I had a very typical Tibetan American upbringing. I felt I was American 5 days of the week and then Tibetan for 2 days, but the 2 days never felt like it was enough because I always wanted to spend more time with my Tibetan friends. You know, like, I was always looking forward to whether it was March 10th or even going to Sunday school on the weekend, just so I can see my Tibetan friends, who I think there was just like a deeper bond that really, you know, put us together and made me feel deeply connected to them.
Talking about Sunday schools, you know, like, it's very popular. Like, even myself growing up, I was in a community where I studied in a non-Tibetan schools. Mm-hmm. I had to learn Tibetan through such gatherings. So how was your experience there?
I was stuck in like third grade for 5 years. it was good. You know, we would have Tibetan reading and writing classes, then take a break, and then we would have Doga dance classes. And we were really blessed, actually, because whenever His Holiness came to Boston, we always had the opportunity to perform. So I think I've performed, me and my friends performed for His Holiness probably at least 3 or 4 times from when I was like 8 till high school. We performed at like the TD Garden where the Boston Celtics play.
Okay.
We performed at Gillette Stadium, so like the really, really big stadiums in the city. So it's also a plus.
That's really amazing, yeah. Especially seeing, you know, like how Tibetans inside America, you know, out of the major footholds in India, are doing their best in preserving and even to an extent of flourishing our culture and tradition. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. So Yangzumla, what led you to be involved closely in the Tibetan freedom movement? Could you share us some insights on some of the movements that you have been part of, namely your local Tibet advocacy in Boston, the Beijing Winter Olympics, and the Paris Bridge Banner, where you and your colleagues, you know, like, raised this massive banner right when Xi Jinping was crossing that bridge in France, saying what is exactly happening in Tibet?
Mm-hmm. I think probably the community that I was from. Also, my dad, he's been super involved in the movement since he was young. Mm-hmm. Like when he lived in Switzerland for like almost a decade, I think, when he was in his 20s or 30s. And so since then, he's been super involved doing like Tumi work like, for the community. And then when he moved, and then when he was in India, he was an MP in a parliament for two terms, which is actually why I was born in Dharamsala. Okay. And I lived in Kanki for 1 year. and then in Boston, we have like a lot of role models who would come to Sunday schools, give us trainings, like, especially SFT. I think I went to my first training when I was like 13 years old, and they made me do like a public speaking workshop, and I was so nervous and anxious. And now I do them for other people while I was working SFT. So it was a very full circle like moment. So that's when you can see like, oh, that work, the work they do really does create all these young leaders now we have in the movement. In terms of campaigns, the banner bridge was, the funny story is, it was actually supposed to be at the other airport. So we found out like very last minute through a journalist that they had switched airports.
Okay.
So we had to drop all of our plans, refocus, and then find a new location. So it was a little bit stressful, but it was super awesome. It was a group of four Tibetan females and one ally. And so it felt really powerful because I think that was the closest that I know that I'll ever be to Xi Jinping, whether it's like I'm right above him or whatever, but it was an opportunity that it'll be really hard to get again to literally drop our message in front of him.
So the thing that you mentioned, it's interesting, like they diverted the road. Do you think that someone got in touch, like, I don't know, like, what do you think? Maybe it's like the Chinese intelligence are so strong that they, you know, get hold of all these things.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but I think they knew that there was a lot happening, especially the community had mobilized a massive protest the day before his visit. And I think they knew that a lot of people would be in town and protesting. So I think like in terms of his security and whatnot, it was pretty tight. But we have a lot of allies and we have a lot of skills and experience and knowledge. So hopefully like we were able to pull it off.
Yeah, indeed. Like what you did really inspired not only us Tibetans, but all our cross-movement allies, you know, like sending a clear message to the president of the People's Republic of China then and there. So, Yang Zumla, like, as I mentioned before, you are part of the International Tibet Network. So what exactly is the International Tibet Network? Like, what's its story behind it? And what are the major campaigns on Tibet that it currently focuses on?
Mm-hmm. So Tibet Network was founded, I believe, in 2000. Mm. So just when we were little kids. And it's actually founded at a CTA meeting. It was at an ITSG, so at an International Tibet Support Group.
Which was recently.
Exactly. And so they had one, I think, in Berlin in 2000. And the sort of everyone in the room felt that there was a void and a need to better coordinate with all the groups so that not that everyone has to be working on the exact same thing at the same time, but just so that there is better coordination and that we're using and collaborating more. And so it was an outcome of that meeting was then ITN's like foundation and setup, which is pretty interesting. Our main purpose is to sort of, you know, we're mandated to offer like a support mechanism to all the TSGs, the Tibet Support Groups, and Tibet NGOs. And so we do that through our regional meetings, which you just came to. We do that by providing resources, action kits, toolkits, and, you know, really kind of being almost like a third party where we're kind of able to be a bit objective and help host a lot of these spaces for everyone to come together with different viewpoints, different NGOs, you know, different backgrounds all over the world for Tibet. And so it's very, very important and feels very much needed.
Indeed. And like even during the meeting of the Asia Regional Tibet, I believe your executive director, Mandy, even mentioned like, I mean, you mentioned right now it was founded in 2000.
Yeah.
So you guys are going to celebrate your silver jubilee next year?
Yes, we have. Yes, we have like working plans right now to celebrate our 25th anniversary, hopefully in Dharamsala.
Okay, that's really amazing. And I believe all of us would look forward to it. So moving on, Yangzumla, like prior to your work at the International Tibet Network, you were the grassroots director of the Students for a Free Tibet. Mm-hmm. So like these are two different organizations, but both basically work for Tibet. Do you find any difference or even similarities between the two?
Yeah. So at SFT, we are like a grassroots mobilization of young people and students. And so we often would put together trainings. And so that part is the same, a lot of trainings and capacity building for different people. And then we focus a lot on strategic campaigns. And so we do that similarly at Tibet Network, but it's almost a different reach because SFT is a lot of Tibetan and young students like all over the world.
Yep.
And at Tibet Network, it's actually a lot of allies and Tibetans who, you know, have been in the, some of them have been in the movement for so long.
Yep.
And so I think the reach is, in that sense, a little bit different. When we were in Hungary for Xi's visit, right after Paris, a few of us went to Budapest and we met with the Tibet support group there, right?
Okay.
And some of the guys have been around for so long, decades and decades. And so I think it's, for me to have worked with all these young people was so special, but now it's also really interesting being able to meet these people who've been in the movement for longer than we've been born, right? And been keeping up and staying activated somehow. And so that's also a different scope in that sense.
Even your executive director, when she mentioned, you know, like she was part of the Free Tibet way back, they did this World Bank campaign, like you get to realize how much and how long they have been working for the Tibet cause.
Yeah.
So very interesting. So Yangzumla, recently during the second International Tibet Youth Forum, like you gave a workshop, a social media workshop with Topchorla.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to learn about your involvement in shutting down the Confucius Institute in the US, particularly in the state of Massachusetts. So could you share us more about this and also the means through which the communist-led People's Republic of China is exerting their influence beyond their own sovereign nation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so at that time, a lot of the Tibet groups, including SFT, was running a campaign to get the Confucius Institute's CIs to be shut down. And so the Tufts CI was the last one in my home state of Massachusetts on a college campus. And so I was like, it's almost like it was almost given to us. And it's like, oh, this is very, our community is so strong, so active, and I thought it would be the perfect, you know, place to start a campaign. And so that was, I think I was an intern at SFT at that time, and it was during COVID, it was in the pandemic.
Okay.
And so they've already been pushing for the Tufts to shut down their CI, but there has been no like on the ground activity. And so me and a few friends, Olo and Pema and Ajahn, like we kind of got together and said, we really need to kick Tufts out of Massachusetts, right? And so made a plan to do what we do best, which is protest. And we said, all right, well, let's start hosting a weekly protest until Tufts shuts down their CI. And so that's kind of where the idea came to be. And after that, we mobilized a campaign, an international campaign, actually, because I was overwhelmed by the amount of people that were following the campaign and supporting it through like the email letters. Like, it was amazing. I was blown away. And so, yeah, so our working committee then became a cross-movement committee. So we had Hong Kongers and Uyghurs and Taiwanese groups working with us. And so then we were so much stronger, right? Because in the beginning, it was just like six of us, I think, and we would just take turns each week. So it'd be like, oh, me and Howard will go today. You guys can go next week, just to make sure that like that presence is there. But some it was during the winter time, during the COVID pandemic, it was a very, some weeks it would just be me and one other person in our, you know, headsets and like mugs and wearing a nice thick jacket. And so in those moments and those times, I'm like, am I really making a difference by standing outside this one building and then chanting? You know, sometimes those thoughts come to my mind because there's not always someone in there. Sometimes there's no students walking by, so you don't really get to feel like you did something. But I think the fact that we showed up every week and mobilized like a strategic campaign against them, where we targeted the administration, I think it did actually make all the difference. And it also told the community, like, we're here every Saturday, join us. And then they actually started coming. So the last protest we had, there was over 100 people there. And we didn't know that was going to be the last protest, right? Because a few days after that, they actually announced that they would no longer be signing the reagreement that fall.
Very interesting in the sense like how the whole community and it formed a cross movement, and like, you know, while doing my research on it, like the first thing I came across were like newspaper coverage. So all these are very interesting, and it shows that if people come together, you know, change is evident. Change can be taking place. Like another example is the recent museums in France, you know, putting Xizang instead of Tibet in English. So when people protest, definitely change is inevitable in a sense.
And you'd be surprised, actually, after the Tufts campaign, they had a pretty bad PR like backlash, right? We were super good about contacting media, getting coverage, really putting our narrative in at the forefront. And so that was, I think, kind of a nightmare for Tufts in terms of, you know, PR. And actually after that, we found out that there were, I think, at least four other universities in the US that slowly shut down their CIs too. And so there's also all these like ripple effects, right? Because now the administrations, the schools know that the Tibet people, the Tibet movement, Tibetan community are serious. They're gonna mobilize. They're gonna send me 5,000 emails to my inbox. They're gonna show up at the doorsteps every week. I think that sent a very strong message. And so you start to see the effects of a strategic campaign like that one.
No, indeed. And another campaign, you know, like which was successful in many ways was the Thermo Fisher campaign, where this very US company was sending DNA kits, you know, to China for that matter, who were using these very kits to get DNA from our sisters and brothers inside occupied Tibet. So could you shed more light on this very campaign?
So I think it was Citizens Lab and then Human Rights Watch that put out the report about the mass DNA. And I think when we all saw it, we were like, oh, this is a really big deal. And we didn't know what to do necessarily, right? Like it's impossible to actually stop them from doing it from outside. But we were trying to think about, what can we do? And then we found out that actually a US company that's based in my hometown again of Boston, Massachusetts, is actually aiding and abetting in this by selling toolkits that actually gets the DNA extracted from individuals. And this was alarming news, right? Because some of the reports have stated that they're even going to people's like elementary schools, middle schools, and getting DNA taken. Yep. And that is obviously very non-consensual. And their big excuse was it's to stop criminals, right? To help with criminal investigations. But why are they going to monasteries and children, schools to then take their DNA if nothing had ever happened? And so what they're actually doing was creating the world's largest database of DNA by using Tibetan people. And I think that has a lot of implications just in the broader international scene, because we don't see stuff like this often. It's very like dystopian, Orwellian type of, you know, like they're able to use that data to then track exactly who's related to who, whether you're from inside Tibet or outside Tibet. Then they can see you moving from whether you're going inside Tibet Lhasa to the next city or the next town. It's quite intensive what they're doing on the information. And so we knew that we had to do something to sort of curtail that. And so we launched that campaign by targeting Thermo Fisher. And so we did a lot. And this was also a campaign that I was a part of while I was at SFT. And the campaign was actually hosted by Tibet Network. And so we worked with like Free Tibet and some other NGOs to really put together this strong campaign, right? And I think it was successful because we found out, actually, I was in Bodh Gaya for Garmisch's teachings, and we got the email. We also went the shareholder route, where we kind of made sure that the shareholders knew exactly what was happening. So that was also like the final big pressure, and then they said that they would stop selling kits to Lhasa police in the new year, and that was at the end of December.
Okay. So in India, what I personally saw was how, in Dharamsala for that matter, like we had this coalition group, Hands Off Tibetan?
Hands Off Tibetan DNA.
Hands Off Tibetan, they were doing this amazing campaign. And in Delhi, I believe it was SFT Delhi, Incidentally, in Delhi, I think Noida area, they had a Thermo Fisher office. So
they're everywhere too. They're massive. So
it was interesting how, you know, even with such a campaign, like, we could tackle and bring justice to even such a big company, whose roots are everywhere for that matter, like you mentioned.
Exactly.
So Yangumla, like India, you know, where we are currently, is the most populous country and also a nation that has stood for Tibet since the illegal occupation by China.
Mm-hmm.
There are many Tibet support groups throughout India. How do you think ITN can mobilize and connect with them?
I think it's true that in our movement, a lot of people are actually aging out.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important for us to constantly be getting allies and supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And especially India is a very crucial, in terms of geopolitics, it's a very crucial space for there to be that sort of network and support base. And so I think there's a lot to be done, not just by us, but also by all the NGOs that are based here, and even just on an individual capacity in terms of educating or, you know, bringing people into recruiting into our movement. But I think recruitment into the movement is the biggest thing, having them sustained and supporting us. And I think that can be done through, like, trainings hosted, having more educational things, whether it's, you know, pamphlets and flyers, or doing teach-ins and going to universities. Like, these are all things that we see all these NGOs, CTA, everyone is doing this, and it's super important. And then I think in terms, I think capacity building, so being able to give all these people who are not in our movement the expertise and tools and skills to be the best advocates they can for our movement. And so that could look like the trainings.
And on top of this, like, during this very Asia regional meeting, like, I found it nice that you invited someone from the India-Tibet Coordination Office, which is based in Delhi. And this office, you know, their main task is to work with the Tibet support groups in India.
Yep.
So I believe, you know, we learned a lot, and this very individual, he carried this forth. And, you know, even I'm based in Delhi, we'll work together to do more. As someone who's been involved with the Tibetan freedom movement for several years, what necessary changes do you believe are needed in taking a major step towards the realization of a free Tibet?
Mm-hmm. I think what is also really stressful and troubling for us sometimes too is, like, the lack of communication or transparency when we're working. I think there's a lot of improvements to be made in terms of, you know, having dialogue with other NGOs, with institutions, with think tanks, with the average Tibetan person that, you know, lives in India, Nepal, abroad. I think we could have more, you know, coordination in terms of that. I know a really big problem for us now is also information gathering from inside Tibet. There's also a lot of space for opportunities to grow there too. Obviously much riskier, much more high tech. But I think there has to be, a way, right, for us to be able to communicate. I think it would be so amazing to be able to communicate right now to a Tibetan person my age living in Tibet. And, like, I feel like that has, you know, a lot of the yearning to return to Tibet or go visit Tibet for the first time, especially for us young people, for the ones who have never been there, I think that comes from just wanting to know what life could have been like, you know, if China had not invaded Tibet. What that could look like. What do they do? You know, like, when someone comes back from Tibet, I always ask them, like, so what are they like in Tibet? And then they always tell me, that's so funny, they always ask us, what are, like, the Chige and Gyal and everyone else, like, what are the Tibetans outside Tibet like? And I feel like that, you know, is so telling, because we all just want to be connected, we just want to know each other, we just want to talk and hang out, and obviously we don't have that privilege. So I think there's a lot of space to hopefully create some more dialogue in that.
You know, I think through technology, even though China has the great firewall, there are some ways and means through which we can, you know, send our messages and share our thoughts. Because at the end of the day, regardless of under which governance you are living, I mean, our brothers and sisters in occupied Tibet are oppressed, but we live in the same earth, and I think we definitely feel the need of connection just because we are Tibetans, you know, at the end of the day. So, Yangzumla, like, this is the final question. Like, what messages do you have to our fellow Tibetans worldwide and the plethora of Tibet supporters who continue to stand in solidarity with us Tibetans?
That's a loaded question.
You know, some people say, like, I'm not in the age of advising, but if you have any message.
I think I would just say that being involved in the Tibet movement has definitely been the most meaningful thing that has happened in my life, and I really wouldn't give that up for anything. I know that I could be doing some other work or finding a better paying job or, you know, getting into different careers, like prioritizing different things, but I think like having that sense of purpose is so important and so strong, and I think a lot of Tibetan people do recognize this, and I hope that every young Tibetan person out there has the opportunity to get involved and then be able to dedicate time. Because when we think about it, the Tibet movement in terms of political activism, it's so small, mm-hmm. right? Like there's X amount of people that, and we know all of them, we can count and name all of them who get to do the work, and being able to do it as a job is definitely a privilege. And I just hope that, you know, especially to all the young Tibetans, that they have this opportunity to at least get involved. And, you know, that little taste, I feel like, is what has strung me along for these couple of years. And I think, and that's why I know I will be involved in the movement until Tibet is free. And I think that before I was super involved, I always thought, I don't know, sometimes I feel like it is a lost cause. Sometimes I feel like, will Tibet be free? Like, look at how powerful China has gotten. But ties are changing, narratives are shifting. People are looking at China differently these days. And I think that, you know, time has really come for that. And I hope that people really get to have a chance to recognize that. And I hope, especially to all the allies, that I would say it's been a long time, but change is coming. It's around the corner. And when we free Tibet, there will be also with us and visiting Tibet too, so it'll be a full circle moment. We just have to see it through.
So Yangla, thank you so much. Like your message, your insights into these very campaigns regarding our Tibetan freedom movements was very valuable, and I believe our audience who tune into it will also gain much from it. So you were busy and you took out much time for this, and you know, we from the Foundation for Nonviolent Alternatives are very thankful for yourself and your organization, the Tibet International Tibet Network. So thank you so much, Yangzumla.
Thank you so much, Samdul. It's been such a pleasure getting to know you better.
More updates and videos via FMVA. Click on the link and please subscribe to our channel. Thank you for watching.